Chances are that during a recent visit to an art museum, you encountered a piece that made you wince, or at least question the odd way in which a painter depicted a subject. Bodies may have been exaggerated, blood may have been present, facial expressions were threatening, and it made you say to yourself, what was going through the head of that artist when they drew this? I know I have, and I didn't quite understand its significance. Until perhaps now. This is Central Standard. I'm Stephen Steigman. And in the first half of today's program, we're going to examine the grotesque in Western art and culture. In the second half, the beauty of music in Western culture and three young promising musicians who are among a group who will compete this weekend on the stage of Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. But first, what makes an image grotesque? Our guide is Francis Connolly, a professor of art history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Francis Connolly, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So take us back for a second. What is art history anyway, and why is it important? We're going to really take it way back here for just a moment. What's the importance of art history, of teaching art history?
Well, I've been teaching art history at UMKC for 25 years now. Mm-hmm. Art history is actually an 18th century discipline. It emerged with the Enlightenment. It's essentially a study of culture and how images, embody cultural mm-hmm. ideals. And so it's kind of a way to, it's a mirror to culture. And one thing I like about the grotesque is that it's very much engaged with cultural issues. Grotesque are controversial because they're usually grabbing onto something, mm-hmm. They're sort of looking at a boundary or a convention and trying to pull at it, push at it, tear it apart in some way or another. So
I guess in all art, for much of human time, a majority of the world was illiterate. So what role did art play in conveying ideas?
A huge role. If you look at medieval cathedrals or churches of any sort, images are a way to tell the stories, to convey meaning, to kind of encapsulate the beliefs of a culture. So, yeah, I would say until the modern era, most art, that's its primary role. Mm-hmm. And museums, I should point out, museums are really 19th century phenomenon, the idea of a public, public museum you could go into. Most of the works at a museum that are pre-Renaissance, pre-1400s, mm-hmm. Were never made with any notion that they would be in a museum with a label on them. Mm-hmm. They had a completely different function to sort of reflect the ideals of a culture back to itself.
Hmm. So, and where did these paintings exist before our museums?
Well, they would be in a lot in the Western world, in churches, in palaces, mm-hmm. Places like that.
Places where they weren't interpreted for the public.
That's right. But a lot in the public square. When you look at Egyptian art, a great deal of those images were in tombs. They mm-hmm. were there to prepare for the afterlife.
Right.
So, but they weren't in museums. Museums serve a great function in that they preserve history. But it's a modern idea to do that. So
let's move on to your focus here, the grotesque. What is the grotesque? How do you define the grotesque?
Well, the title of the book, actually, I had to campaign to put this last part on it.
Oh, really?
Yes. But the title is The Grotesque in Western Art and Culture, The Image at Play. And one reason I wanted that was I think it's the most important aspect of the grotesque, but also it's perhaps the most unexpected. When people nowadays, well, I can tell you, whenever people ask me what I'm working on and I say the grotesque, there's this look.
What do they think?
Well, I think they think something disgusting, horrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, like that's what I think
work
of.
On horror movies, right. That kind of thing.
And why is that not quite accurate?
Well, because the grotesque historically has had a lot of other roles to play, and that's more of a modern way that the term has sort of migrated to describe that. The word, when it was coined around the time of Michelangelo, the word was coined to describe his work, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you usually don't associate Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci with mm-hmm. a grotesque, right? They're supposed to be these great Renaissance artists. Okay. So it was coined to describe work of great improvisation, of great imagination, again, breaking conventions.
And at the time, the convention was, I guess, various times. Conventional meant what? Let's just so we have a baseline here. Ooh. Conventional meant staring at people in their normal forms,
right.
Not exaggerated,
right.
And then continue.
Okay, so a grotesque image might distort certain things. Mm-hmm. It might, for example, perspective was developed in the Renaissance where mm-hmm. you sort of have this perfect illusion. Well, a lot of grotesque images played around with perspective. They would play optical tricks. There's something called an anamorphosis where it's like a wormhole perspective that you have a regular perspective where you look into an image and anamorphosis sort of burrows into it from another direction. So you can see two different images, but you have to look from two different directions.
And
does that make sense?
I think so.
So that would just be an example.
The power of radio.
If
we could see it, we can try to imagine
right.
it, I suppose.
Well, I can give you an example.
Sure, go
and
ahead.
It's in the book. I'm not sure if it's one of the ones you could get on the website, but it's by Hans Holbein. And it's called The French Ambassadors. And anybody could just look that up on the web. It's easy to see it. Anyway, it shows these two French ambassadors. It's a straightforward view. They're standing in perspective. Okay, they're successful, worldly men.
Mm-hmm.
So that's looking straight on in the image. If you go and stand by the side of the image, you know, on the wall, and look at it sideways, there's this other perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows a skull. But you can only see that skull if you stand on the side. If you stand in the front, it looks like a kind of weird piece of driftwood.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But the skull is an anamorphosis. Leonardo da Vinci is the person who developed this idea. But it also undercuts the complete idea of the main image. The main image shows worldly success, people who have made it. The skull, you see, is what's called memento mori. It reminds mm-hmm. you that, yeah, that's great, but you're going to – this will be your end no matter what. So this classic grotesque where it sets up one convention and then knocks the legs out from underneath
Interesting.
It. So you can see, yeah.
So when did we first see the grotesque in Western art?
Well, there are
– Approximately. I'm not asking for a particular
right.
year. But.
Well, it's complicated because, for example, in medieval art, there are lots of gargoyles and things mm-hmm. like that that now we would describe as grotesque. They didn't.
They didn't describe – that was just normal, ordinary
right.
conventional art,
right.
for lack of a better term.
Right. But it's in the Renaissance when they coined this term. So it becomes sort of this artistic concept. And it means great invention and so on. The other thing that's happening at the same time is, we're almost at the time of Mardi Gras right now, right? So carnival.
Right. Yeah.
Carnival, which comes right before Lent. And in European folk culture, there was the carnival culture that happened, you know, where for usually a few weeks up until Lent, there would be lots of, wild behavior, the world.
That's a nice way right. of saying it.
they would sort of there were themes like the world upside down, mm-hmm. where you would have people mocking the powerful. The peasants were in charge.
Mm-hmm.
They would have feast of fools, where they would mock church ceremonies and so on. That also becomes part of the grotesque too. It's related to caricature. It's mm-hmm. like spoofing all the things that are held dear. For a short time. So that also gets gathered in. And in fact, in the book, the different chapters of the book are organized according to these different strands of the grotesque. So mm-hmm. one of the things that got me really interested in working on this was I knew what the grotesque meant now. But when I looked back at Renaissance, I had done my master's work in Renaissance mm-hmm. art, it meant something completely different.
Hmm.
So I was interested in, well, what's happened? You know, where the change? And the other thing is in modern art, the grotesque in all its forms, carnivalesque, mm-hmm. improvisational, or what we think of as sort of more traumatic, scary, disgusting grotesque, that's all over the place in modern art. But when I looked, there was just nothing written on it, which is, you know, you could take either as a red flag, like mm-hmm. maybe there's a reason no one's written on this, or as just, you know, this wonderful opportunity to really add something new to the discussion.
Hmm. As long as we're on this Mardi Gras theme,
yes.
Let's talk about some, because I think this is perhaps the one area of the grotesque that many of our listeners
right.
will be able to relate to.
Right.
Give me an example of what makes, of a kind of a classic carnival, either a costume or image that has that has retained its look throughout the centuries. And what about it? What about it? It makes so much fun of something, or I'm not quite sure where I'm going here. Something that we would say, oh, this hasn't changed so much over, four centuries or so.
Right. That's a tough question as far as a particular image, but I can give
you just an example.
An example, yeah. One of the kinds of images you see in carnivalesque imagery in the past, like Renaissance and later, is the idea of the woman on top, like women riding on top of men, women, like women wear the pants, that kind of the sort of the reversal of power roles. And that's still, you know, you still see things like that today. Some of the great works of, well, here's an example. It's over at the Nelson Atkins, Willem de Kooning. He's an abstract expressionist artist, and he has these kind of monstrous women figures. And that comes out, they're sort of rowdy, and they're sort of half scary and half funny, but they're like staring down the viewer. Instead of the traditional sort of reclining Venus figure that you just gaze upon, she's the one in control. She's the one staring at the viewer. So that woman on top idea, meaning our world upside down, where you have a traditional relationship flipped, would be one example.
Well, and of course, culture has changed over 400, 500 years, whereas the idea of the woman being in control is
not so scary.
Right. It's an ordinary, everyday activity. So how have artists adapted to what is grotesque now that wasn't grotesque? I'm sorry, what is grotesque now that a century ago, people would have, you know, said, that's really grotesque.
Right. Would you mind if I just reverse that?
Sure,
I can
absolutely
think of something.
Yeah.
One of the things that got me interested in this topic, one of several things, but is in the 19th century, sort of the age of imperialism, European countries are colonizing all parts of the world. And so a lot of imagery, for example, from Africa, from the South Pacific, starts to come into European ethnographic collections. And at that time, for example, a sculpture from West Africa is routinely described as grotesque over and over and over. So let's say 1880, you have a description of this. It's in an ethnographic museum or a missionary collection. It's described as grotesque. By 1930, you have it in the Museum of Modern Art, alongside other modern artworks, and described as classical and beautiful. So I was really interested in what boundary has that crossed? See what I'm saying?
Well, you meant use the word beauty here.
Yes.
Can the grotesque be beautiful?
I think the grotesque, that's partly thinking of it just as something that's ugly or deformed.
Right.
And it depends what you mean by beauty.
I think
the grotesque is always intriguing.
Yes.
I'm not sure if it cares about being beautiful. I'll put it more that way. It's more because when something is beautiful, aesthetically, I think one of the elements of beauty is that all the parts are unified. Okay. Well, the grotesque is disunity. It's something where you have several things that are not completely connected and they're sort of all brought together. And so there are all these seams and contradictions and arguments going on basically within the image. And the viewer then has to decide, well, you know, what do I think about this? What's going on? The grotesque also almost, well, unlike beauty, almost always brings up ethical questions as well as aesthetic ones. You know, is it right that it's shown this way? There's a really great image.
Let's talk about that. In fact,
sure.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yes.
And by the way, these are images that two things. One, these are the types of images that when you go and see them at a museum, you can't just walk past them and look at them briefly and go on to the next piece. These are ones that make you stop and focus for a few minutes at least at a time to figure out what they're. We have a whole bunch of images on our website, kcur.org. Go to the Central Standard page and you'll see these images. You can follow along with us here. Tell me about the one you wanted to talk about. The one that comes to mind, and maybe we'll get to it eventually, is the big fish eating eat the little fish. But because I think that's a classic example here.
That's wonderful.
Was there one you wanted to touch on first before that one?
Yes, it's by Otto Dix, D-I-X. He's a German artist working in 1920, fought in World War I, in the trenches, so he saw all the horrors of it. He did this painting, sort of painting a collage called Crippled War Veterans mm-hmm. Playing a Game of Cards, 1920. And it shows four men sitting around the table, and each one of them is so horribly disfigured from his war wounds. Mm-hmm. And so they've got all these kind of Rube Goldberg-type attachments, you know. So if you put all of them together, they would make one whole man. And they're kind of, you know, mm-hmm. basically, you yeah. know, there's little tin
like an ear cone for...
Yes, things like that.
Right, okay.
I mean, the kind of old chair legs used for mm-hmm. legs. I mean, it's... and it's caricatured, so they're cartoon-like. Now, this is, I mean, 2 years after the war ended. And you can imagine, for example, if you just put that in today's context...
I say that it almost sounds like a little too soon, a little too early to do something
yeah,
like that.
I mean, there were these you know, World War I was the first modern war in all its glory with, you know, gas and machine guns and so on. So there was a lot of...
very deadly war. Of it.
Yes, and this was evident to everyone. So the idea that he would show this as a kind of almost cartoon.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a great example of a grotesque because on the one hand, I think the first thing most people then and even now would say is, he's going too far. You know, why would he? Is he making fun of them? Mm-hmm. Why would he do this? Why would he show it this way? But he's also a war veteran. So on the other hand, you think, well, I mean, if you know that. Well, he's got some sort of justification.
Some right to do that.
Right, some right to do it. But why show it as a caricature? And I guess I have several thoughts about that. One is that it draws you in to look at these figures because there's that element of humor in a way that if it was just a photographic documentary, and actually there was one published in Germany in, I think, 1925, mm-hmm. It was titled something like Against War, and it showed portraits of people with these horrible disfigurements. So, you know, who would look at that? Very few people. But Dix draws you in with this humor. But he's also, I think, raising bigger questions about why they are so disfigured. And if people are upset by what's them being shown, the next question is, well, you know, what culturally, what were the... what brought this about? Mm-hmm. So it's a way of bringing that. It's sort of, maybe this isn't a great example, it's sort of like the court jester saying things or presenting things in a way that's funny. It's very, very dark humor, but it's a way to sort of force the conversation. So to my mind, that's a really great example of how the grotesque takes things on. Mm-hmm. It's always engaged in what's going on at the time.
I was going to say that artists, just about every artist, even you know today's artists, have a statement, have an artist statement, have mm-hmm. a they right. want their art to right. mean something,
right. they,
even if it's you know paint splash, you know random patterns mm-hmm. on a wall. But it sounds like art, you know that you're describing, the grotesque, has a multiple meanings. I mean,
yes.
it's intentionally.
Right.
Telling a story that these artists who decided, you know, I'm not satisfied with just sitting back and doing what everybody else is doing.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. The grotesque is always one way to describe it is as a boundary creature. It's always taking the edge of something, some kind of convention. It can be a social convention. It can be an artistic convention. It can be more just sort of individual identity, and it's pushing at that. It's bringing in things that contradict it, mm-hmm. sort of like that anamorphosis I was talking mm-hmm. about earlier, where you have something that completely contradicts the main story. It's
yeah.
over there sort of, excuse me, you know, interrupting constantly, making you always aware of this other version of the story. So John Ruskin, who's a really great 19th century writer, described the grotesque as a lot of things, unlike things brought together in a moment, you know, just all brought together, all in contradiction, and it's for the viewer to work it out, which is another thing I like about the grotesque. Beautiful things essentially announce their beauty.
Yeah.
They're already there. And all you can do is think, wow, I'm not that beautiful. Or, you know, isn't that beautiful?
The grotesque makes me feel good about myself.
That's right. There you go. That's right.
Sorry.
It's completely why I worked on it. Yeah, but the grotesque, you know, wants to know, you know, you have to go in and, in fact, Ruskin describes it as leaping the gap. It creates all these gaps. It's for the viewer to leap it. And, for example, back to the Otto Dix crippled war veterans, you might very well say, no, I think that's really offensive, you know. But you have to say it's offensive, but why did he do it? You know, that's the next thing. And what does it say about this entire generation of young men chewed up in this war machine and no one can even say what the war was about now? So
let's turn to one of the by the way, I should mention that you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking with Francis Connolly, a professor of art history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're talking about the grotesque. And I want to turn to one of the images we've posted at KCUR.org. It is called Big Fish Eat the Little Fish. It's it was put out 1557, so a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Describe this image to me, and as you describe it to me, I'm going to ask you some questions about it, and then you're going to tell me what I'm missing here, because there is so much going on in this image. It's a huge, more or less beached fish in essence, with lots of little fishes falling out of every orifice, including ones cut open by a fisherman. Tell me about this piece of work. Who was the artist?
The artist is Peter Bruegel, the elder. And if people are familiar with Hieronymus Bosch, Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, at any rate, he was influenced by him. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the first things I want to say is, you know, when you look at images of the past, we're just so inundated with images today that it's easy to kind of overlook how densely packed a lot of images are, because there were so many, there were such fewer numbers, and the artists really,
they didn't have Google image search to find.
That's right. So there's a lot put into this.
Right.
So sort of foreground, there's a father and his son, and another man holding also a fish, and they're in a little boat by the shore, and the father points at the big fish and says, Eche, which means here it is, basically. There's this large fish. There had been some beached whales at this time. So some people think that might have been one of his. But, yes, out of its mouth, all kinds of fish coming out. There's a man with a gigantic – there are lots of shifts in scale.
Yes.
Things that are large or small. There's a man with a big knife that's cutting open the side of this fish, and out gushes all kinds of others. And in the background, there are even more fish being hung up. There's some flying fish in the sky. It's, it's a really what we would call today a surrealistic image. The surrealism's 1920s. Yeah. So, and the title, The Big Fish Eat the Little Fish, the general interpretation is that that comes from a proverb, which we would still use today. The big fish eat the little fish. Mm-hmm. The rich get richer. The poor get poorer.
Right.
That same kind of thing, that power preys on the weak. And yeah. So, and this father points at the fish and essentially says, here's the way of the world, son, basically. Haven't I always told you this?
Mm.
But I was really intrigued by that ecce, E-C-C-E, because that is the word you always see over the crucifixion.
Mm.
Behold the man. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, because fishes are a Christian symbol.
Right.
And Bruegel also does lots of other, like the seven deadly sins. I mean, he does a lot of, obviously, this is a Christian era and a lot of Christian imagery. And I became interested in the other way to interpret this, that it's not just the ways of the world are the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, that sort of thing. But what if the fish were more a Christ-like symbol, where the most powerful sacrifices himself? And there's lots of, without going into, there's lots of, in Christian theology, the idea of being the body of Christ and so on. So there are a lot of really interesting things here. And then in the background, if you look, then I started to notice there's a boat on top of a mountain back there.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of another boat that's on top of a mountain except for Noah and the Ark.
Of course.
So another salvation theme. So I guess what I'm trying to say about this is, if you read it as a grotesque, which it is, because there's all these contradictions. It's a scene of death. The fish is dead.
Right.
But it's also a scene of rebirth, because it's generating all these other fish. right?
Well, you're assuming those other fish are alive.
Maybe so. Well, some of them are still eating other smaller fish.
Right.
If you look, some of the fish coming out are in the process of eating other.
That's right, they are.
So there's this kind of eating, dying thing going on, which is, again, very much part of the Carnivalesque. Carnivalesque is about every possible orifice and thing, all the right. operations of the body. Just think of Animal House or Adolescent Humor.
Uh-huh.
That's the Carnivalesque. So, but okay, so you have this kind of all these kind of contradictions going on in this really weird scene. So I thought, well, it could be about the ways of the world, but it could at the same time, if you flip that, turn it upside down, it could be about another way that's completely alternate to that.
What role does the grotesque play in feminism?
Oh, really interesting role.
Change the tone here for just a moment.
That's right. Let's fast forward. Yeah. Well, actually, this summer there's going to be at the Nelson Atkins, I'm not sure the exact date, but a show on Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. And the reason I mentioned that is Frida Kahlo is a great example, one of the earliest women artists to embrace the grotesque as a way to propose an alternate way to look at the body, especially the female body.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of feminist artists, a lot of diaspora artists, artists who like, for example, might have grown up in Africa or Palestine, but now work in the West. A lot of artists who cross boundaries also embrace the grotesque and use it because it's a way to – well, let me go back to feminists. It's a way to take the status quo and rupture it, pull at it in some way or another. And since the female body is the most gazed at object in Western art, period, you know, when you have women begin to represent themselves, there's a question, well, how do you do that in a way that represents some other way of thinking about the body? So, yeah, a lot of Frida Kahlo is a great example because she also had a lot of medical issues, a lot of physical suffering. But she there's this really great image also in the book. It's at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where she shows herself seated in a chair and she's cut off all her hair and her hair's all around her.
Mm.
And this is, again, a great example of the grotesque, like flipping things, because hair, long, beautiful hair, flowing hair, is one of those key markers of femininity and beauty. And it's used, again, through Western art.
Right.
Botticelli's famous Birth of Venus, where she has this really long, she's standing in the long flowing hair. She's on this half shell, right? Venus on the half shell. So you have that, but here's Frida Kahlo whacking it all off. And that hair on the ground is kind of writhing around. It's not just laying there like you're in a beauty shop. It's it's moving around, kind of snakily moving. So it's the kind of Medusa threatening things out of place, woman out of place. Yeah. So that's it's a big part of feminist imagery.
Speaking of Medusa, there's a great image of Rubens, the head of Medusa.
Oh, good. Is that on the website?
That's on our website as well. That's a great –
in color, I hope.
It is in color, yes. In all its glory.
Uh-huh. Gory.
And so gory. That's a good one. Tell me a bit about this image as well. Obviously, we have the head of the only the head of Medusa, and from it calls, of course, all the snakes that were. But the snakes appeared to be alive, even though she is clearly dead.
Yes, well, you know the myth of Medusa, once beautiful, then cursed, and I'll go all into that. But yeah, so her most beautiful asset, obviously hair, turns to snakes, even when she is killed. Every drop of her blood, this is written up in Ovid, every drop of her blood, once it hits the ground, turns into a snake. So she's still lethal, even though as long as she's bleeding. And part of the story is part of her blood falls into the ocean. That's what becomes coral. Coral, I should say.
No, it's
coral. Anyway, so she's shown decapitated, and out of her neck, bloody neck, stream all these serpents and salamanders. And actually, Rubens had a natural history painter do that part, a guy who specialized in painting naturalia. So it won't surprise you to know that that painting, where it originally was owned by someone in their home, they had it covered with a cloth.
Really?
I think probably for two reasons. Well, probably three. One is just to keep it from getting too much sun and
right.
light. Another is, who wants to look at that all the time? I mean, it really is a frightful, creepily
hanging over the kitchen table,
right? I know. But the other is, you can imagine saying, oh, look at this new Rubens I have, and then pulling it back and the kind of zap that you get when you look at that image, because it is, it's really, really quite frightful.
Well, in this, in modern age, let's just fast forward to 2013. Is there anything normal left to push the boundaries of? I mean, we are so enamored with werewolves and vampires.
That's right.
Give me some modern examples of can an artist still shock somebody, like this Rubens painting could shock somebody back in the 1600s?
Well, the boundaries of our bodies and the fact that we're mortal, I think, always still shocks us. No one can quite believe that they're not going
right.
to go on forever. So, and there are always social conventions that exist. I guess I also want to say that the grotesque isn't always out there just to blast your eyes out, and shock you. But we all, sort of depend on what's familiar and what's conventional. So there's always, the thing is, the grotesque, the boundaries are always moving. One thing I'm interested in a lot right now are artists who would be artists for example, the African diaspora. Many of them are using a lot of the sort of stereotypes about African art, and stereotypes of Western modernism to create these kind of grotesque that challenge our presumptions about what we're looking at. And so it's still going on. And with the world, cultural world, not just commercial world, becoming more and more global, there are all kinds of cultural traditions that are colliding, in various ways. And so, there's plenty more, I'm sure.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Frances Connolly, thank you so much for being
with
us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Frances Connolly is a professor of art history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Her book is called The Grotesque in Western Art and Culture, The Image at Play. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk with three young musicians who will be performing in Helzberg Hall this week. All that when we return in just a moment.